By the way, I still haven't figured out what to talk about today, so I have a few things, and Peter said he has to get out in the middle of the first hour, so I haven't yet made up my mind which one to do first. Since that's the case, I'll try to explain the title first. That might be useful. And the first part of the title is pretty easy to explain. So let's recall what a metric space is. It's a set of points P and a distance function d that maps pairs of points to non-negative real numbers. And it has the following properties. It's symmetric. That's the third property. It's non-zero, we already mentioned that. It's zero if and only if both x and y are the same point. And the most important property is the third property. It satisfies the triangle inequality. So that's a metric space. And here are a few examples of metric spaces. So if we have a graph G, and I presume I don't have to say what a graph is. If someone doesn't know what a graph is, please let me know. So if you have a graph G, then there's a natural metric defined on G, which is the shortest path metric. So the metric is on the node set of G, and the distance between two nodes is simply the number of edges, the minimum number of edges along a path connecting the two nodes. So this makes sense, of course, only if the graph is connected, and not all graphs are connected. Came up at some point yesterday, or the day before. Then we have natural examples from functional analysis, the sequence spaces LP, and the function spaces capital LP, where P is any number between 1 and infinity. So these are metric spaces, and metric geometry is the study of these objects and their properties. Now, throughout this talk, we're usually going to assume that our metric space is finite. So the point set P is going to be a finite point set. Okay. Now, the second part, I actually don't know what it means. It just looked like a nice thing to put on the title. So let me try, nevertheless, to say what it might mean. So we're talking about the following very general setting. We have a data set P, so we think of P as being anything, say text documents or whatever. Now the elements of P, as far as we're concerned, I mean, we're not interested in their real meaning. What we're interested in is their geometric representation. So we either have some explicit representation. That would be, for example, points in d-dimensional real space with some interesting norm induced on them. Or there's some implicit representation. So we don't have representations for individual points in the data set, but we know something about relationships between points. So, for example, there is a metric induced on the set of points in our data set. So those are the two possibilities of what we have. We usually assume that the distance indicates dissimilarity. So if points are far away, either in some explicit representation or in some implicit pairwise relationships, if they're they're far apart, it means they're dissimilar, and if they're close, it indicates that these are similar data items. And now what we're looking at is questions that can be formed rigorously. And I guess what I mean by that is that something like finding criminal activities against giants in old Icelandic documents is probably not something that we will talk about here. Say partitioning our data set into subsets of small diameter would be something that would fall into what we may talk about here. Okay, so this is the title. And what I'm planning to do in these 2 hours is two or three things. The first thing would be to give a general survey about one rather fruitful research direction in metric geometry that has some implications to our data analysis. So I think I'll do this first. The second thing would be to give a detailed account of one specific result that gives examples of many useful concepts. And then I also might want to talk a bit about or to give some comments on many techniques that are more useful than everything that I'm going to talk about during these 2 hours, more useful in practice, I mean, that come up from my research area. And but they're mostly covered by other talks, so I have only a few comments to say about them. Okay, so let's start here. This topic that I want to survey, and I won't go into the results much, but just state that, is the use of metric decompositions. So one way to think about this is that this is a metric analog of the dyadic partitions that Peter presented in our meeting in Maze Landing. Let's first define them and then see what we can do with them. So we have a metric space PD, P is the point set, and the partition of P is simply the obvious thing, so it's we divide P into disjoint subsets whose union is the entire set P. So one of the important parameters of a partition would be the diameter of a partition, and that's simply the maximum diameter of one of the point sets. Now, diameter in a metric space, in a discrete metric space more specifically, is simply the maximum distance between any 2 points. So if we have PC sub I, that's a subset of the metric space, so there's a submetric space there, and we look at the maximum distance between 2 points in that piece, that's the diameter of CI, and the maximum over I of that is the diameter of the partition. Now, a decomposition is simply a distribution over such partitions. And the diameter of a decomposition is the maximum diameter of a partition in the support of this distribution.
What is the distribution of a partition?
It's just a probability distribution. Since we assume that P is finite, everything is discrete here, so we just assign a non-negative number to every possible partition, which is between 0 and 1, and they sum up to 1.
Okay, I just want to get side to probability distribution,
yeah,
and distribution in the other things.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's oh sorry. It's a probability distribution over partitions C. Some notation here, so we'll denote by BXR the ball of radius R around X, which in case of discrete spaces, we have to specify what we mean by a ball. So this is simply the set of points whose distance from X is at most R.
So what do you mean by C is from support of C?
I'm sorry?
What do you mean by C is in support?
Okay, so again, the easy way to explain this is think about discrete spaces. So, you know, they're all the possible partitions of P. That's a finite number of those that are combinatorially distinct. Some of them have probability zero, and some of them have probability greater than zero. So the support of C is simply the set of partitions that have probability greater than zero.
Okay, so if P is finite, then the diameter of this C would be just the diameter of for the largest distance from two points in P.
No, because it could be that all the partitions that are in the support of C actually are partitions of P into very small pieces. And the diameter of a partition is the diameter of the largest.
So you're going to list over all partitions.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so if we have such a decomposition, and this is the object that we will be interested in throughout the first hour, we will say that it is delta alpha padded if and only if the following two things happen. So first of all, the diameter of the decomposition is at most delta, which means that in every partition in the support of the decomposition, every piece in the partition has diameter at most delta. And the second part is that if we take any point in the metric space, and we look at the ball of radius delta over alpha around this point X, this ball is completely contained in one single piece of this random partition with constant probability. So the 1/8 here is insignificant. It could be a different constant. I mean, not one, of course, but we don't really have to stick to 1/8. So when we pick a random partition from this curly C decomposition, one piece of it will completely capture this ball with constant probability. So that's a delta alpha padded decomposition. And this is exactly the structure that will replace the dyadic cubes in L2.
Should we think which are large constant being paid close to negative?
Yeah, so you should think of alpha as a large constant. In fact, we will soon see that it's not even a constant. So it's going to be even larger than a constant.
So do you mean for all
No. What I meant here, the probability that if we pick a random partition, that there exists one piece in that partition that contains the entire ball, all the points in the ball, that's constant.
So clearly, you have a collection of partitions, and then you have a probability measure defined on this where the objects are partitions. The point is, sort of an average partition is good.
Yeah. In other words, in an average partition, X is far away from the boundary of this partition. That's what this means, in other words.
So in the extreme case, like, you know, each partition contains only one point. So that's
yeah.
Okay.
No, that's not okay, because because that one, if you look at a ball,
mm-hmm.
Okay, this would be okay if delta is zero, of course, because then the diameter of each piece is zero, and the ball of radius zero around the point is obviously contained in each piece. But if delta is bigger than zero, then you want to capture bigger balls, and then partitioning the space into single points actually won't work.
Basically, it says that every point is contained both within the ball.
Okay, so maybe this example will help us a little bit. We'll take a very simple metric, actually a continuous metric in this case, which is just the real line. And here is, maybe you can do slightly better, but this is sort of the most trivial thing you could think of. Here is a delta 4 pattern decomposition. So this delta 4 pattern decomposition has a support of size 2. There are just two partitions. We partition the line into pieces of length delta, consecutive pieces of length delta, and then we shift this partition by delta over 2. And the reason why this is a delta over 4 partition is because if you take what's a ball of radius delta over 4 on the line, it's simply a segment of length delta over 2.
Mm-hmm.
And if this segment is contained in the, if the beginning of the segment is in the first half of, say, this interval, then it's obviously completely contained in this interval. If it's in the second half of this interval, well, it might not be contained in this interval, but it will be contained in this interval. So with probability at least a half, or exactly a half in this case, these two partitions are equally probable. We get the padding that we require. Okay, now the perhaps surprising thing is that something like this is true in every metric space, except that the performance is a bit worse. So instead of the 4, we're going to get something different, and this is the theorem that says that for every metric space and for every scale delta, there is a delta times order log p padded decomposition. So what this means is that we can partition the metric space into randomly into pieces of diameter delta, such that every point is with constant probability is well within the piece that contains it, and the distance from to the boundary is about delta over something proportional to log the number of points. So of course, when I say for every metric space, I mean for every finite metric space. So every finite metric space can has a padded decomposition where the padding factor is log the number of points. And this theorem has been known for quite some time, since 1990. Now, more recently, this theorem has been somewhat improved, not in the worst case, but locally. So this is the theorem I want to talk a bit about. It says the following thing. So again, for every metric space and for every scale, there is a delta alpha padded decomposition, but now alpha is not some universal constant. I mean, not some constant throughout the metric space. It's something specific to each point. So alpha is a function of the point x, and alpha, instead of being log n, or log the number of points, is log of the ratio between the number of points in a ball of radius delta over 2 around x, and the number of points in a ball of radius delta over 8 around x. And again, this 2 and 8 are rather arbitrary. So we take two balls of where the radii differ by a constant factor. And you see that in the worst case, because everything is finite here, this is at least 1, because x is contained here, and this is at most n. So in the worst case, this again gives you log n, but locally it might give you better things, or for certain metric spaces it might give you better things, and that's important for most of the applications that I'll discuss soon. Now, this bound is not the best thing that you can say here, so Mendel and Naor have a slightly tighter analysis of this that actually is slightly better than this, but I won't go into that. That's not needed for almost everything that I'm going to talk about. I want to show a proof of this. So here's the proof. The construction is quite simple. So let's denote the set of points in the metric space by the numbers 1 through n. And we're going to pick two things at random. So we're going to generate a random partition now in order to define the padded decomposition. And the random partition is governed by two random variables. Sigma, which is a permutation over the point set. So we pick a random permutation uniformly at random. And we also pick a parameter rho, which is going to be between a quarter and a half. I think that was pre-arranged. At least that's what they told me in advance. So the other parameter that we're picking is a parameter rho that is distributed uniformly in the interval 1 quarter and 1 half. And now the partition is defined by these two parameters in a very simple manner. So we take the first point in the permutation, and we take a ball of radius rho times delta around it, and that's going to be our first piece. Now we take the second point in the permutation. It might already be contained in the piece, in which case it doesn't matter. We still look at it, and we look at a ball with the same radius, rho times delta around it. But of this ball, we only take the points that haven't been grabbed so far. So it might be the entire ball, but it might be only part of the ball. And that's going to be our second piece. Unless it's empty, of course, in which case we don't take anything. And then we keep doing this. So we go over the points in the order sigma. And each point generates a piece, which is the remaining ball of radius rho over delta, rho times delta around it. So now we want to show that this is indeed a padded decomposition with the parameters that were stated. So let's look at all the points in the metric space, and let's denote by d sub y the distance of y to a point x. So we're looking at a specific point x. What we want to show is that the ball around x is indeed contained in a single piece with decent probability. That's what we're trying to show. So we're going to sort all the points in the metric space according to their distance from x. And let's say they're already sorted. So d sub 1 is simply x itself, so d sub 1 will be 0. And that's at most d sub 2, and so forth, up to d sub k minus 1, which is the last point whose distance from x is, k minus 1 is the last point whose distance is below delta over 4 minus r. R is just a parameter that we will later fix. Then there's d sub k and so forth. And then dl is the last point whose distance from x is at most delta over 2. So why are these two points? Well, the issue is this. These points, actually this should have been delta over 2 plus r, but never mind. These points are so close to x that if we get to them and x hasn't been picked up yet, or say that the entire ball around x hasn't been picked up yet by any piece, these guys will grab the entire ball. So these are really good guys. They never cut the ball if we get to them. Now these guys here, and again, I think it should be delta over 2 plus r, not very important. These things are so far away that they're never going to reach the ball. So no matter what rho is, it's not. They're too far to actually grab anything, any point in the ball around x. And we have to worry about the stuff here in the middle, because the stuff here in the middle might grab the entire ball, it might grab part of the ball, it might grab none of the ball, and we have to deal with that. Okay, so we're going to say that a point y cuts the ball bxr if and only if all the points that proceeded in this order of distance from x appear after it in the permutation. So this is the first point. Y is the first point in the set of points that are no further than y from x that appears in the permutation. And rho is between dy minus r over delta and dy plus r over delta. So in this range, the importance of this range is that when rho is in this range, there is a fear that y would grab only some of the points in the ball of radius r around x and not all of them. Let's see this picture here. So here is x. We're interested in this ball of radius r around x. Here is y. And we're interested in the values of rho that cut part of the ball, but not all of it. So they grab part of the ball and not all of it. Now, actually, this case might still be okay, because there might, since the metric space is discrete, it's possible that this piece here contains no points whatsoever. But we will still regard this as a problem. So we're not going to account for the fact that perhaps our range for r still includes values that are okay. Now, why is it important that y will be the first one in among the points that are closer to x than y? Well, let's look at another point z. So here's another point z, and z is closer to x than y. You'll have to trust me on that. Mm-hmm. It is true that it's closer. I checked it. So if z came before y, it was using the same distance, rho times delta. And because it's closer, it either would have grabbed some of the ball, or it would have grabbed all of the ball. In any case, y would not be able to harm it any further. So the only way that y might harm the ball that we're interested in, you can't see my pointing at the screen, right? Point here. So the only way that it can harm this ball potentially is if it's the first one in the sequence. Okay, so so now we can compute the probability that there exists some y that cuts the ball. This is the bad event. And remember, the first k minus 1 points can't cut the ball. They're too close. So the first point that can cut the ball is point number k. And the probability that it's first among the first k points is just 1 over k, because we are picking a permutation uniformly at random. And then what's the chance that rho is in the right range? The range, the length of the range is something like r over delta. It's 2r over delta. And rho is uniformly distributed in an interval of length a quarter. So the probability is just 8r over delta. Then the next point, of course, the chance of it being first is 1 over k plus 1, same probability of rho being in the right range, and so forth. And the last point that we need to consider is point number L, because point number L plus 1 is already too far to grab any part of the ball. So what we get here is some constant times r over delta times log L minus log k, or log L over k. And what we should simply do is to take r, which is the minimum between delta over 8 and delta over 2c times this thing, which is exactly the guarantee that we had for the padding. So that completes the proof. Now, this very simple construction has in the past 6 years or so has found a tremendous number of applications, and I'm going to talk about a few of them. Some of them relate to data analysis, some of them are less related to data analysis, but I may mention them as well. So let's talk about extensions first. So take a graph G, and suppose that we have a subset of the nodes P, and a metric that is induced on the subset of nodes P. So this would be some sort of segmentation. We have a graph, some of the nodes are labeled, and we want to label the rest of the nodes with the same label set. I'll later talk about a slightly more practical version of this problem. So what we want to do, we want to find the mapping of all the nodes to the set of labeled nodes. So this mapping will simply label now the entire graph. Right? Some of the nodes are labeled. The set P will be a set of nodes with distinct labels, and we want to label the rest of the nodes with these labels. And we want to minimize the total stretch of the edges in the graph. So we assume that nodes that are connected by an edge, the edge indicates that these nodes would like to get the same label. So if they get different labels, they're unhappy, and we have to pay for it. And what we pay for it is the distance between the two labels. So this is something called zero extension. We extend this metric D on P to a semi-metric on the entire set of nodes, such that every node has distance zero to at least one of the nodes in P. Now this problem is actually, this minimization problem is hard to compute. Something that's easier to compute is to find the metric extension of D. So we have a metric on a subset of the nodes of the graph. And we can extend this metric to a metric on the entire graph. So we find the metric D prime on the entire graph, and that's a metric that extends D. So for any pair of nodes in P, D prime should be equal to D. And we have the same objective function, so we want to minimize the stretch of the edges. Now this is something that is possible to compute in polynomial time. I like this problem, which is NP hard. And the question that we might want to ask or answer is whether or not such a metric extension gives us any indication about the zero extension. So the answer is that indeed it does, and this is the theorem. It says that basically you can take such a metric extension and convert it into a zero extension, and what you pay is almost a logarithmic factor, logarithmic in the number of points. So the edges, edges will be stretched on average by an additional factor of log p over log log. In fact, this will be true for every individual edge. So this transformation will be probabilistic. There will be a probabilistic mapping. And every edge will be hit meaning stretched, by this additional factor, potentially, by at most this factor. So here is maybe a picture that might help you to understand what I was just saying. I'm not going to show any additional proofs, by the way, so just statements. So think of this, yellow ellipse as being a nice metric space. This is the metric extension. And this is the set P. So we want to cut this into pieces. There we go. So we want to cut this into pieces, and each piece will be mapped now to the point in P that is contained into it. But you see now that if we just cut it into pieces like this, we're going to tear this yellow membrane apart in certain areas, and there could be tiny distances here that will be stretched by a huge amount. So what this theorem says is that in fact, instead of cutting it deterministically, you can find some sort of probabilistic way to cut it, so that still some edge, some tiny edges in every possible cut will be stretched a lot, but on average, no edge is going to be stretched too much. Okay. Now there's a similar result that again follows from, and this thing, by the way, this partition is done using these padded decompositions. So everything that I'm talking about now is done using padded decompositions. So there's a similar result in the continuous world, which says the following thing. Take a metric space QD and the finite subset of points P in this metric space, and take any Banach space B, and take any mapping of this subset P to the Banach space B. Then one can extend this mapping F to a mapping F prime, so the extension is to the entire metric space Q, so that the Lipschitz constant of the mapping grows by the same log P over log log P factor at most. And in fact, in both of these results, there's still a gap between what we know how to prove and what might be the best result. So the best lower bounds on this factor here and in the previous theorem is just square root of log p. And we don't know what the answer is. It seems like, I should mention that it seems like a non-trivial answer. Part of the reason it's non-trivial is because the bounds here bound the stretch of a pair of points that are cut apart by the diameters of these clusters that grab them. Now, if you use such a bound, then it's not too difficult to construct examples where this would be the best factor. So one such example would be derived from just the d-dimensional grid of side length d, where d is something like log p. So what this means is that in order to improve such a bound, what you would need to do, you would need to use large clusters that have a relatively large boundary, but you would need to show that most edges on the boundary are stretched by much less than the radius of the cluster. And that somehow requires the clusters to be placed in a nice order, so that they're the points that you map the clusters to are actually much closer to each other than the diameters of these clusters. So that's one reason why this seems like a difficult question. And improving the lower bound also seems like a difficult question. One of the reasons for that is that you need some sort of intermediate expansion in your bad examples in order to get something better than this bound. Okay, how much time do I have left?
What?
Oh, there's not. Oh, wonderful.
In the next hour.
Yeah. Well, I want to wrap this up as much as I can. So here's another application. We will say that a metric D is tree supported if there is a weighted tree T such that D is simply the tree metric D sub T. Now, tree metrics are nice because they're very simple. It's very easy to solve, or not always, but it's often very easy to solve various problems on trees. So if you have a problem on an arbitrary metric, it would be nice if you could reduce it to a problem on a tree, to the same problem on a tree, because then you're more likely to solve it at all, or at least quickly. So there is this general theorem that says that, in essence, every problem on a metric can be reduced to a problem on tree metrics. Well, it's a bit too general what I'm saying, but of course there are certain restrictions to this. First of all, you have to pay something for this transformation, and of course it works for, say, linear objective functions or in certain other cases. So what the theorem says is that if you have a finite metric space, PD, then there is a distribution on tree-supported metrics, QD prime. So QD prime is now a random variable. It's a distribution over such metrics, where Q always contains the points at P. D prime dominates D, so every distance in the tree is at least as big as the original distance. And for every pair of points X, Y, and P, the expectation over all the trees of D prime X, Y is bounded by the original distance, but times a logarithmic factor. So we might stretch distances by log p factor. Now, as a remark, this proves that every metric space can be embedded into L2 with every finite metric space PD can be embedded into L2 with distortion log P. And that was originally proven by Bourdain using a completely different proof. Now, in fact, the statement of the theorem as I put it here does not imply this, because not every tree metric is an L2 metric. But the trees that come out of this construction that uses the padded decompositions is are very special trees. So they are trees. They're level trees, and the weights on the levels, as you go from the leaves to the root, grow by a constant factor in each step. So in particular, these tree metrics are ultrametrics. I think Peter mentioned that in May's landing. These tree metrics are ultrametrics, and ultrametrics are L2 metrics. So in fact, each one of these trees can be embedded into L2, and therefore the distribution can be embedded into L2. So this is, in fact, a useful construction for the following labeling problem. So suppose we have a graph G, and the label set L. So now the graph G and the label set are different entities altogether. And this label set L is endowed with a metric D. And in addition to that, we have a cost function. So for every node in the graph, and for every label, there is some cost of assigning that label to the node. So if you want a concrete example in mind, one can think of, say, a raster image in a computer. So the pixels will be the nodes of the graph. The edges will indicate adjacency of pixels. So every pixel will have four neighbors, or actually most pixels, not the ones on the boundaries. The label set could be, say, the intensity of the pixel, the gray scale intensity of the pixel, or some other interesting parameter for the pixel. And let's say if it's grayscale, then there's some natural linear metric that relates some different grayscales. So things that are shades that are closer to each other will have a smaller distance than shades that are far apart. And for other label sets, you would have maybe different metrics that would be endowed on them. And our goal would be to label this graph as cheaply as possible. So the cost of a labeling is going to be the sum of two terms. The first term would be the cost of labeling each node on its own. So that would be just the label assignment cost for that node. If a node X got a label f of x, then the cost would be a of x f of x. And the second term would come from the structure of the graph. So again, this graph represents some data, and we assume that data items that are connected by an edge would like to get the same label or labels that are close by. So we have to pay for every edge the distance between the labels of its endpoints. Now, the only result that we know for this problem in its full generality uses this decomposition of metrics into trees. So we take the metric D on the label set L, we decompose it into tree metrics, we represent it as a distribution over tree metrics, and then on tree metrics, in fact, the problem can be solved exactly. So one can optimize this. In general, it's hard to optimize. Even for very small label sets and very special graphs and very specific metrics like the uniform metric. So on trees it's easy, well it maybe not easy, but it can be solved. And that gives a log L approximation algorithm for the problem in its full generality. Okay, so that's another application of padded decompositions. And here's another one, perhaps less related to data analysis. Still, I want to explain it. So, this is the theorem. Suppose we have a metric that has a delta alpha padded decomposition. So alpha now is a uniform parameter. It bounds the padding in all locations. And it has such a decomposition for every scale delta. Then there is a mapping of this metric space to L2 such that the this is just the distortion of this embedding F. It's the Lipschitz constant of the mapping times the Lipschitz constant of the inverse mapping. The inverse here is restricted to the image of P, of course, so that there will be an inverse. And this is called the distortion of the mapping. This is bounded by square root of alpha times log P. So, by the way, the distortion is, of course, always at least one. If it's one, it means that the embedding is isometric. And this means that distances are distorted by, at most, this factor. So if you remember from the beginning of the talk, we said that alpha can always be bounded by log P. And therefore, this bound in particular says that every metric space, every finite metric space can be embedded into L2 with distortion log P, which is again Bourgain's theorem and yet another proof of it. But in cases where the padding is better, you get, of course, better embeddings. Yeah, I didn't mention the authors in previous slides, but maybe here. So the first author, Rao, had the alpha here. And the second paper just moved the alpha here. And that's what required the padded decompositions. These are the ones that I showed you. So even though the condition is sort of on the uniform padding, the proof requires the non-uniform. Another type of problems where these paddings only recently proven useful is metric Ramsey properties. So here's an example. You may be familiar with Dvoretsky's theorem that says that every normed space, there is a linear subspace that is close to a Euclidean space, and then there are bounds on the dimension that subspace that had been developed through several papers. So there is a, in the discrete world, it turns out that there are much stronger similar properties. What you would expect from the continuous case is that there will be a set of points of logarithmic size. So if you have an endpoint network space, that would have log n points that are nearly Euclidean. And it turns out that discrete metric spaces have much larger structures that are very ordered. So every metric space P, and for every epsilon between 0 and 1, there is a subset of size P to the power of 1 minus epsilon that is very close to Euclidean. In fact, it's not only very close to Euclidean, it's very close to being an ultramet. So it's much stronger than just being Euclidean. So the distortion is C over epsilon. And this theorem in this form improves a long list of results. The last improvement is to get the dependency on epsilon right. But this is the only step that really required the padded equation. So the previous results did not use it. Okay, so one last example, and there are several others. I think some of them you'll hear in other talks. In Neil's talk, he may mention something. Local versus global properties. So the question here is, you have a metric space, and you know that every large subset of it embeds, say, into L1 with small distortion. So is it true that the entire space is close to being L1? And the answer is that yes, if the subsets are very, very large. So we take our metric space PD, and if every subset of size delta times P embeds into LP with distortion at most alpha, then we can say that the entire space embeds with distortion at most alpha times log 1 over P, and log 1 over delta. So you see, if delta is a constant, if every set of, say, a quarter of the points embeds into LP, then the entire space with distortion alpha, then the entire space embeds into LP with distortion 2 alpha. Well, actually, there are additional constants here that I didn't include. So on the other hand, if let's say Q is P to the 1 minus epsilon for some constant epsilon, then you will already get logarithmic distortion here, which you could get without this condition. So you need very, very large sets to fix in order to get the distortion. I think this part is over. Could mention a few more things. Well, I wanted to mention doubling metrics. So doubling metrics are metrics that don't grow very fast. And they have better decompositions. It's a good thing to know. I won't go over this because we don't have time. And also planar metrics have very good decompositions. So in both cases, the decomposition parameter is a constant. Now, planar metrics are not doubling, so it doesn't follow from results. And here is one more open problem. Can we embed planar metrics into L1 with constant distortion? This only gives square root of log n, the decomposition.